You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Folklore, a podcast of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Thurston, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I spoke with Professor Levy Gibbs of Dartmouth College about his new book, Song King, Connecting People, Places, and Past in Contemporary China, recently published with the University of Hawaii Press as part of the Music and Performing Arts of Asia and the Pacific series. Song King examines the life and music of Wang Xiangrong, a famous folk song king of Western China, as he uses music to mediate between different places and different temporalities in Western China and beyond. Our conversation was really fascinating for the ways that we looked at how Wang Xiangrong simultaneously is folk and elite, the ways in which he uses and modulates his repertoire between different performances, and the ways that that creates song worlds for his audiences. I hope you'll join me in listening as I talk with Professor Levy Gibbs. Thank you.
Levy, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, Levy, I guess to start off, I'd like to know a little bit more about you and let our listeners know a little bit more about you. What's your folklore origin story?
Well, that's a great question. And it's kind of tied up in how this book came to be. So I'll try to give a sort of brief version of that. But basically, I first saw a concert of the singer that I ended up writing the book about in the summer of 1999. It was the summer right after my freshman year in college. Hard to believe it's 20 years ago almost. And I was just really blown away by his voice and what I felt was kind of the authenticity of the feeling expressed in his song at the time. And so I bought a CD and I tried to kind of learn the songs, even though I didn't know the dialect or anything. And then over the years, he kept appearing in different parts of my life. I was just like very interested. I just like kind of fascinated by his story. And so that fall, I did a sophomore year abroad at the Shanghai Conservatory, and one of our classes was on regional Chinese culture through folk song, and we learned some of his songs. And then later, the following summer, I was doing research for my senior thesis, and I interviewed some retired folk song collectors in Xi'an, one of them had discovered the singer, and later, I had the opportunity in 2006 to go to a conference in this area in northern Shanxi province, and was able to interview him. And then I've gone back several times since. But I knew I wanted to do this project. And so when I was looking at different graduate programs, I considered doing, you know, ethnomusicology or cultural anthropology, but really folklore kind of stood out in that it allowed me to be able to focus on an individual artist and also individual performances. And at the same time, it gave me this foundation in performance theory that addressed a lot of the genres that I was looking at. So not just folk songs, but like personal narratives and speeches. This is a singer who likes to talk a lot and is very eloquent. And then so kind of looking at different kind of parallel narratives between the narrative of the song, the narrative that he speaks on stage when you interview him about his life. And at the same time, working in a folklore program allowed me to think about what I was seeing in a broader context. So there would be people not just working on folklore in different parts of China, but from around the world who might be looking at similar issues in terms of narrative and expressive culture. And I feel like that helped me to situate what I was doing in a kind of broader context.
Great. So I guess, you know, this book has its focus on this one singer, Wang Xiangrong, and from this area of northern China. And I think perhaps our listeners won't be so familiar with either. And I guess maybe one of the best places to start is, who is Wang Xiangrong?
That is a great question. So he has become known as the folk song king of northern Shanxi province. So I'll talk about that. Shanxi province is kind of northern central / northwest China. For those listeners who are familiar with the Terracotta Warriors in Xi'an, that is in the same province, the central part of it. So this is a bit to the north of that. In an area that is near the intersection of the Yellow River and the Great Wall, and to the north of it is Inner Mongolia, which is the northernmost region of China. So he has become known both as folk song king of northern Shanxi province and also the folk song king of western China. There are other folk song kings of western China, I should mention. But his life is a very interesting example of how one becomes an iconic singer, a representative singer. He spent his childhood in a small mountain village near the intersection of the Great Wall and the Yellow River. He was born in 1952, which is just after the founding of the People's Republic in 1949. So his life kind of parallels China's rise in an interesting way. And during the course of his career, his life and his songs and performances have come to highlight various facets of social identity in contemporary China. So after he won a string of regional contests in the late 1970s, and then a national contest in Beijing in 1980, which at that time he met Deng Xiaoping. After that, he was hired by a regional song and dance troupe and traveled on regional, national, and international tours. He's performed in Europe and the US. And later, he relocated to the provincial capital of Xi'an, and there has assumed positions of power in several associations. He was selected as a national level representative transmitter for the intangible cultural heritage of Northern Shanxi folk songs in 2009. And in recent years, he has appeared on nationally televised Chinese New Year galas. He has served as a judge in TV singing contests. And he's also acted in television and film since the 1980s. So one of his more famous appearances was as Mao Zedong's horse groom in a TV production about Mao's time in northern Shanxi. So that's just a sort of summary of his life.
What a life. I mean, he's sort of done it all. And I guess that kind of leads me to my next question. I think this book was really interesting in part because you talk about singers, and I think a lot of your theory is developed around this idea that folk singers in particular are both folk and elite. And, you know, I think that from a Western perspective, I'm not sure that that's necessarily something people necessarily associate with folk song. I'm wondering if you can explain a little bit about how a folk singer like Wang Xiaorong can be both folk and elite.
That's a really good question. It kind of ties into this idea of song king and song queen, which are Chinese terms for representative singers. You'll have like the song king of a particular region or an area, or sometimes the song king or song queen of a particular genre, but the genres are associated with particular regions. So there's always a kind of representation of a place and a group of people. And what's interesting about these kind of iconic singers is that they do have this kind of dual identity. So if they're representing the people, they have to be part of the people. So this singer would talk about how, you know, he's still a common person, a regular guy. But at the same time, there has to be a reason why they're able to be these kind of focal representative singers. And that's the kind of elite part of it. And that kind of dual identity goes back to, you have these kind of earlier legends of song gods and song goddesses in parts of China who, you know, come to a place and teach people how to sing, and they're kind of become representative singers of an area, sometimes through kind of song battles, like rap battle type situations. And they also, if you look at their stories, you know, they'll have alternative narratives of like they were born as a peasant, or they were born as the daughter of the emperor, you know, something. So it's kind of hybrid identity that sort of bridges a rural common populace with a sort of elite centers of power type populace. And I think that allows them to be able to travel between groups, which is another sort of theme that I look at, is how in order to become representative of larger and larger places and identities, a singer has to be able to pivot to kind of cater to multiple groups in order to sort of expand their representative reach. So all of that ties into the dual identity, I think.
Right. Very cool. And I think that's certainly something that seems to make, again, Wang Xiaorong and these sort of folk song kings and queens such powerful figures to study, right? Particularly in the context of China. Mm-hmm. Very neat. So finally, before we get onto the book itself, or more deeply into the book itself, as somebody who's finishing his, or trying to finish his own book manuscript, I was impressed by sort of the presentation that you use, where you have song texts in English, pinyin romanization and Chinese characters quoted in full. You have a number of photos, quotes of your conversations with Wang Xiaorong, and song recordings freely available on Amazon. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the decisions surrounding this, and particularly the companion recordings.
So I should make clear that the companion recordings, that's actually Wang's CD that was published in 2006. So a lot of the songs that I talk about in the book are available on his CD. Some of them are other songs. But what I tried to do with the English translation, the pronunciation, and the characters is to make it easy for different audiences to follow along. So if you read Chinese, you can see the Chinese characters. If you don't, the pronunciation helps you at least follow along in the song, and it's paralleled with the translation, so you can kind of see what he's singing at each point in the song. And I mentioned the track numbers for the CD. But I did try several different kind of structures for that, and I think it's an interesting challenge working with texts that are not commonly known. You know, it's not like I'm talking about a play by Shakespeare that I can just refer to because everyone should have read that. I tried at one point putting the songs in an appendix at the end, but I really ended up feeling that it has to be kind of in the heart of it so you can see what I'm talking about. And likewise with the quotes from interviews with Wong, he is, again, such a great speaker. He's very smart. And I wanted to let as much as possible his words to shine through, even though a lot of some of the theory that I add in is more of my own. I also went back and forth between trying to kind of make it just about his expression of his self. And then, you know, in the end, it's a conversation. So it's a conversation between the conversations I had with him, with his songs, and then with different other books and theory that I've worked with. The end product is something of multiple revisions, I should say.
Well, it ends up really nice and looks very natural and easy. I thinking about my own multilingual productions, how you use the sort of the full extent of what we can do with media and print, it's really nice.
Thank you.
So moving on to chapter one, which is entitled The Meaning of Life. In this, you discuss singer heroes and stories of singer heroes and how elements of these seem to resonate with Wang Xiangrong's own story. A singer's success, you suggest, is, quote, a result of his or her ability to engage with different others through song in mutually defining conversations. How does this work? And are there any good examples that you can give?
Yeah, so what was interesting to me is how different elements of Wang's life resonate not only with the life stories of other contemporary singers in China and also around the world, but also these kind of legends of these song gods and goddesses in the past, that they have similar elements in the stories that I think reflect these social tensions. These singers are moving from often kind of a rural village type context to other geographical contexts. So sometimes to new places, sometimes to capitals of nations. And those different places have different kind of ethical standards and just sort of unspoken norms. And I think that the singers, by crossing between those geographical spaces, bring these kind of social tensions that otherwise are not always sort of brought to the fore. And so if you look at the stories of these older song gods and goddesses, you know, sometimes there's one who is this kind of very flirtatious guy who flirts with this an actual goddess and then gets punished for it. And so there's kind of stories of sexual transgression and things like that. Or in other ones, there's things that have to do with sort of class tensions. There's a song battle that involves, sort of the elite of local society and then the sort of common people. So they bring those kind of issues to the fore. And if you look at the narratives of Wang's narrative, also has multiple versions. Sometimes it's told as a sort of rags to riches story. One of the documentaries about him, the title was From Shepherd Boy to Folk Song King. And it talks about how, you know, he had all these jobs as like a coal miner and a peasant and a farmer. And he's become this, you know, wealthy, famous, great singer. So it's this rags to riches story. But you also find different narratives about things like his love life, his marriage, and taken in the context of other singers' lives, you see that a lot in, you know, like country singers or blues singers, that there is this kind of public interest in their romantic life. And often the sort of choices they make are scrutinized and reflect kind of tensions, underlying tensions in society as society is kind of changing, or maybe sort of what I said about the different kind of unspoken norms in different geographical places within, say, a nation. So I think that aspect of the singers is sort of what captivates people, what people find so intriguing about their lives. And that's sort of what I wanted to talk about in that chapter.
Yeah, it really comes out. It has me thinking other Chinese stories like Liu Sanjie, right?
Yeah.
Her sister Liu. And so, yeah, there seems to be a lot of similarity.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then moving to chapter two, you talked about Wang Xiangrong's education in song, particularly with reference, it seems, to banquet singers, spirit mediums, and actors at temple fairs. How did the songs and singers of his youth help shape his conceptions of what being a song king meant?
That's a great question. So what was interesting to me is he, in our many conversations, he kept talking about how as a child, there was no concept of singing as a professional career, like making money off of it. He said, you know, everybody sang when I was a child, like it was just more common. And there wasn't this idea of this kind of like song king in the sense that it came to be later. But he did talk about these memorable, influential individuals, singers in his childhood. And so I wanted to look at what he might have learned from those singers based on his comments about them, and his discussions. And so a couple of things that I noticed, and so his village is this very small village that doesn't even appear on maps, or hadn't until perhaps recently. It had, I think, 60 people back when in the 50s when he was a child. When I visited it in 2012, there were only 3 elderly people left there, and that was it. And a couple of the sort of people that he remembers from childhood, there was this spirit medium that was called Eldest Grandfather, who had the ability, was, according to local tradition, was chosen by the gods and could do these rituals where he would invite local gods, some of whom were said to be ancestors who had so everyone in the village is surnamed Wang. And so there would be a god whose surname was Wang, who was supposed to be, had turned into a spirit or a god. And in the rituals, the spirit medium would use song to invite that god and other gods to the village, offer them food and wine and tea and stuff like that, and then ask them for help with illnesses. If a child was ill, if someone had had an accident, they would ask for cures. And then also through song, the medium would sing in the god's voice and give a kind of Chinese herbal remedy, you know, find this herb and this and mix it together, and then this will happen, you know. So he would explain what happened, the origins of the illness, and then how to cure it. And so from that singer, he would talk about the singer's authority. You know, he said, like, he learned to sing these songs, but he says, you know, I just did it for fun as a game, but I was always aware that to do those songs the real way, you had to be chosen by the gods, you had to have that authority. And so the question of how do you build the authority to represent, whether it be gods or villagers or an entire province or a nation, is still this question of building that kind of narrative of why does the singer why is a singer authorized to sing this particular song and represent this particular group of people? And at the same time, the songs from his youth were also very situated in the local topography. They would refer to the mountain and the ravine, the mountain where his village was located and the ravine next to it. And so there was very much a connection between place and song. And that is something that I noticed that he developed when he later was kind of singing and creating and adapting songs that he said to be were region representing Northern Shanxi or representing China. He was very much thinking about how the images of landscapes and nature in the songs and the characters who are singing in the songs had to be connected to these larger regions. He called it like expanding the song. So that is something, you know, coming from a small village to become a representative of a nation, I think that he learned in this education through song. And then regarding the sort of local, there was a local tradition of folk opera called two-person opera, Arentai in Chinese. And that that was a semi kind of professional. There were singers who would perform at festivals, and they were kind of the closest thing to like a professional singer that he had. And you know, he did study with one of those singers and kind of pursued. He was very much into that. He recalls when he was a child how he would stand on his bed and use that as a stage for his friends and like perform on, you know, standing on the bed as if it were a stage. So I think that that was another sort of influence from his childhood.
Oh, that's great. And, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned sort of this idea of sort of moving scales between sort of local and regional and national, because it seems that that's the topic also of your next chapter, chapter three, representing the region. You look at Wang as a regional representative, so leaving the village, which, just to clarify, three people in the village?
That's when I visited in 2012. So I don't know now. There might not be anyone.
That's incredible. That as a sort of rural exodus story, that's...
And that's very, common in that region. So I've visited other villages where you'll see very... like elderly people and maybe like baby, like very young people, because all of the school age, college age kids are in the cities, and then the older working age people are also in the cities. So that seems to be very common in that area.
And it's not seasonal migrant or anything like that. It's a full depopulation.
I mean, I don't know. They might come back and visit during Chinese New Year, but it's, yeah, it seems to be pretty persistent.
Okay, wow. All right, so anyways, sorry, I just had to clarify. Moving on with this sort of idea of representing the region, you talk about beginning with the period when Wang went to work at the Yulin Folk Arts Troupe, mm-hmm. which Yulin is the local sort of prefectural capital, right?
Right, that's correct.
Okay, and you sort of talk about sort of the requirements of this jump in scale to a city, and sort of now representing not just the village but the region. And can you talk about how folk songs have been adapted to the stage more generally, and specifically how Wang was able to represent his region so capably?
Yeah, so he talks about when he joined this regional song and dance troupe in the 80s. How he felt that there weren't enough songs that could truly represent this broader region and its history. The purpose of this song and dance troupe was essentially to advertise the region for investment and economic purposes, just to kind of make the region more well known. And so he needed kind of songs that were worthy of the large scale stage in like a big auditorium or television performances or things like that. And he felt that, you know, even though he knew a lot of songs from his childhood and growing up, a lot of them were sort of tied to what he called, you know, smaller context. So there would be songs for like a Chinese New Year's festival in, you know, a small village. And so he gives this really interesting example of a song that was from this kind of village festival. It's a very, you know, it has a very upbeat kind of quick tempo. It's supposed to be humorous. There would be a man dressed up as an old man with like a fake beard and in kind of a papier-mâché boat. It was called Boat on Dry Land is the sort of genre. And the song would be about the old man taking a younger woman on the boat with him down south and, you know, hoping that romance would ensue, only to find that when they get to the south, she runs off with a younger man and leaves him in the cold. He pointed out that song and he said, you know, that is a very local context. That doesn't work for, you know, the big region, right? But what he did is he adapted the melody from that song. And what he did is he said that he slowed it down and he turned it into a kind of more dramatic, stoic, majestic kind of melody. And then he transformed the boatman into this kind of heroic, pensive, almost like leader of the people type image. So it's still a boatman, but in his new song, which was performed for the opening sequence of a TV drama about revolutionary China, and also he performed it on stage. The boatman is, you know, leading this boatload of people that maybe is a symbol of the region or the nation. It's a bit ambiguous and purposefully so. He's leading them through the crashing waves and the beating sun and the storm across the Yellow River to the other shore. And so it's just interesting. He talks about how all of those changes, slowing it down, changing the lyrics, changing the image of the boatman, resulted in what he called expanding the song and making it region representing. And if you look at other more widely known iconic songs in China, for example, The East is Red is a very famous one. There are stories of how songs like that also were kind of expanded. So maybe in the earlier version of The East is Red, which is about praising Mao and the Communist Party and that kind of thing. In the earlier versions, they compare Mao to a oil lamp that lights up the house, and to talk about sort of his illuminating influence on the people. But then there was a lot of discussion about that, like, oh, that's too small. That's only one house. You know, we need something, an image that's bigger, of bigger scope. So they change it to the sun, because the sun not only, you know, brightens all of China, but the entire world. It has this more kind of universal presence to it. So there's different ways that sort of metaphors or images are transferred to be able to capture broader and broader representational bases. So that's something that's interesting that I thought happened with that song that he talks about.
Right. And it's just really interesting to me, just sort of all of these regional moves and how intentional they are. And I guess in some ways, these can even go from local to regional to international even. In chapter 4, which you entitled Culture Paves the Way, looks at a joint project between a Chinese coal company and the American Dow Chemical Company in Midland, Michigan. Can you briefly discuss this event and what happened in Wong's songs as he performs to an international audience and how culture paves the way for relationships between larger entities in our current era of global capitalism?
Sure. So the slogan for this region, so different regions in China have had different slogans for kind of economic development. So the one in Yuling was culture paves the way, economics comes to sing the opera. And what happened was there is a large coal industry that has sort of risen in the last couple of decades in this area. And there was a point where they were looking to put together a joint venture with Dow Chemical Company. And part of that involved a cultural exchange. And in the cultural exchange, Dow Chemical's headquarters is in Midland, Michigan, as you mentioned, and they fund a lot of kind of local theaters, and there's a museum. So in the museum, they had a four-month celebration of Chinese culture, and the culminating event for that was a performance by Wang's troupe, the troupe with which he worked. And what's interesting, and this was sort of meant to share Chinese culture with Midwesterners in the US, but also to kind of highlight the local culture of this region and to let people know more about Yuling, because that's the purpose. And I'm guessing that you know, is sort of a cultural exchange that's happening as this economic arrangement is being worked out as well. And what's interesting in terms of Wang's performance is he said that when he performs abroad, he always chooses local love songs. He never would sing like in China, sometimes he will sing a song like The East is Red that is kind of more like patriotic or nationalistic. And so in the sort of international cultural exchange context, he said what's important is to establish sort of the common humanity between what I'm representing and the audience. So everyone, you know, everyone understands love. The song that he sang was a duet called The Flowers Bloom in May. It's a riddle song with him and another a woman, a female singer. And so basically a back and forth asking, you know, what kind of flower blooms in January? What kind of flower blooms in March? And then answering. And then it's a sort of metaphor for the blossoming love between the couple. But it also, in that context, I think served nicely as a metaphor for the blossoming relationship between two nations, to regions within those nations, to companies within those regions. So there's a lot of nice kind of parallels there. And it's just interesting to me that the song he's singing is from that folk drama genre, folk opera genre from his youth in that village. And he's used songs like that at different points in his career, and they just keep kind of working for different contexts, which is interesting.
Absolutely. And I also think it's interesting the way it's sort of, he goes more local to become more global, if you will. So the songs are more local when he goes into those global or international situations, which I just think is sort of an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, and I think I've seen different scholars talking about that recently, that there is kind of this back and forth between, you know, everywhere is becoming the same, and then this desire to distinguish a locality and like what makes us special. You want to be able to connect to make yourself important and relevant, but you also need to kind of distinguish what is like unique about yourself. So I think it's a clever way to do that.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, well, and I think that's, I mean, that last little point is also particularly interesting in light of the following chapter. You sort of talking about sort of the way establishing connections with audiences. In chapter 5, you actually begin with a quote from previous podcast guest Ian Brody and his work on stand-up comedy, in which he describes the comedian as an intimate stranger who must engage with audiences across different worldviews and social identities. In this chapter, you're using conversations with Wong and with folk song collectors to look at the decisions that singers make to adapt performances to contexts and how dirty songs created space for discussion of public morality. Can you talk a little bit about this, please?
Yeah. So I would call them body songs because dirty implies a value judgment. But no, I mean, fair enough, because that's how they tend to be seen. But yeah, so it was interesting to me with regard to Ian Brody's book on stand-up comedy. You know, he's talking about a lot of what he was saying about stand-up comics kind of resonated with what I was seeing with singers, which is that they have to stand kind of on the edge of a group and tell the group about itself, or to be kind of a border walker between that group and other groups. So you have to be close enough to kind of be taken into the conversation, to be part of the broader, to be one with the audience, but at the same time, distant enough to kind of be up there on stage and justify why you're up there on stage. So the impetus for that chapter is that I found other versions of the song that I mentioned earlier. So the one where you had the village boatman song and then the sort of iconic stoic boatman region representing song that he did for the TV series. Then there was a third version of the song that he would, which was a body version, that he would sometimes perform for groups of friends, or sometimes if a folk song scholar, like a Chinese scholar, came and asked for that type of song, he would sing this. And what was interesting is that as I talked to him about those types of songs, he had thought about this a lot, and he talked about how you really have to gauge your audience, and there are different expectations depending on different types of audiences. If you blow it by singing a song that's perceived as inappropriate with an audience, then you like lose them, and then that hurts your career. So that ability to accurately get your audience quickly is something that's very important for being able to negotiate the multiple kind of social spheres that a representative singer has to do. And what's interesting is that I think he, if you look at the sort of sequence of performances, sequence of songs and speech within a particular performance that he does, I think he's doing something very interesting, that is, he will sing something that is kind of more familiar to the audience, like, hey, this is this like familiar song that everybody knows. And then he will like sing another one that's like a little unfamiliar, not totally exotic, but something a little more distant. For example, he will, in some local occasions, he would sing like a revolutionary song from the Cultural Revolution that was familiar to a lot of audiences, but he would sing it in Mongolian because he has this whole thing about how he spent time in Inner Mongolia. And so it's something that sounds familiar, but is like also like othered. And I think he kind of, over the course of a performance, will kind of shift closer and further away from the audience subtly to kind of have them feel where they are. It's like, oh, because I think if it's all like too familiar, it would just be boring. And if it's all like too different, they just wouldn't get it, and then he would lose them. But by kind of being able to hover at that line at the border, I think that is where you're really like helping people to kind of position themselves in a changing world. That was the sort of idea that I had from that chapter.
Oh, great. And I think it's an idea that comes even more explicit in the following chapter, where you're talking about sort of a performance in Wang's home region with this this shifting between familiar and exotic material. How do audiences engage with that shift? You sort of just told us a little bit about how Wang does it and how he sees it, but how do audiences engage with this shifting material, and how does it help further create his sort of public persona?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it sometimes is hard to tell. I mean, they get very excited, you know, if there is one of his iconic songs. You will just see, like, if it's a wedding or something, there will be like all of these people with their iPhones, you know, hovered around taking, you know, videos and that kind of thing. And sometimes they'll sing along with parts of it. What was interesting were a couple of occasions where he was performing in his home region, and I was with him, and you know, he's trying to kind of juggle multiple narratives about, you know, his life, his rags to riches story, together with the kind of rags to riches story of the region, how the region used to be kind of invisible, like other parts of China didn't know about it, and now it's become very prominent and, you know, wealthy. And then he, you know, tries to position his own narrative in that, and how he through his songs has helped kind of bring pride and fame to the region. So part of that narrative, he would turn to have me perform after him, but like introduce it as evidence of the global attraction of this local culture. He's like, look, you know, this guy came all the way from America to study this stuff, and look how he sings the songs, and look how, you know, he tried to use that as a sort of evidence of the attraction of this local culture. And sometimes, you know, there would be, if it was like a business opening, there was one time where this local boss of this business, you know, got up and said, you know, he would ask for stuff like he wanted me to translate some of the local songs into English and sing them spontaneously like that. Or, you know, they would want to, I think they were kind of, in retrospect, I think it was sort of playing with this concept of identity, like, you know, hearing the songs by someone from who's stayed in the village their entire life is different from hearing the songs from someone like Wang, like the singer who has been abroad and received acclaim and come back. That is, has this kind of additional layer to it. And then having him bring me and sing, I almost felt like in retrospect that I became one of his kind of sung persona, like I was able to do something that he needed at that point in the performance, just based on what I look like and my ability to sing. And so I think that those different kind of layers of how different sort of personal narratives and performances come together in these kind of interesting ways play into that negotiation of identity that audiences are seeking.
Right. And I think for any of us who have spent a lot of time in China, that sort of getting called up to sing is an experience that we'll know, but it also seems to be doing something quite specific in this, in your case. And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Like, I feel it, as you know, a lot of people in general and scholars, when you go to China, you know, there will often be kind of banquet events where part of it is, you know, going around the table and having people sing a song or do a poem. And it's kind of contributing something to this sense of commonality that is the event, and trying to bring some element of your own perspective to it, but sort of building that kind of group feeling together through the contribution of these different poems and songs and things like that.
Absolutely. So in chapter 7, you move from a very local performance in chapter 6 to a very national one. And you're looking at this one very famous song, The Infinite Bends of the Yellow River. And it begins with this wonderful description of Wang's performance at CCTV's Spring Festival Gala, which is, for listeners who may be unfamiliar, it's a massive television variety show that gets live broadcast across China and around the world to welcome in the Spring Festival and the Chinese New Year. In this narrative and in this chapter, you kind of bring this international figure to something that is simultaneously local to his home area, regional to the Shanxi area he calls home, and an important national symbol at a time of great transition. And I wonder if you could just sort of describe this a little bit more. I remember seeing you give a talk about the infinite bends of the Yellow River at a conference once. And I was wondering if you could just sort of talk a little bit more about this performance and its place in the show and what it's doing in connecting past, present, and future.
Sure. One of the things that I'm trying to talk about in that chapter is how he fuses together these parallel narratives, some of which I've mentioned already, is the kind of rags to riches story of his own life and how he became famous through song, and then the turn from the invisibility of his home village that didn't appear on a map, and the region more broadly, to its kind of hyper visibility now, you know, with the rise of the coal industry. It's referred to as China's Kuwait. And then that is also paralleled with China's rise over the past few decades. And all of that gets layered into, I think, the narrative of the song, which is deceptively simple. It's a two-stanza, essentially a riddle song. And the first stanza asks these questions: how many bends are there in the Yellow River? How many boats are on those bends? How many boatmen, how many boatmen and how many oars and that kind of thing. And then the second stanza answers each of those questions with the number 99, which in Chinese signifies an infinite number. So there are 99 bends in the Yellow River, et cetera, et cetera. And what's interesting is that looking at the history of the song, it was first composed in 1920, which was during this kind of intellectual renaissance in called the May 4th period in China, which was a period right after the end of the dynasty, the final dynasty, when a lot of intellectuals and writers were arguing about and considering, things about Chinese history and where China was headed in the future. And so in that context, the sort of questioning, it's kind of questioning the past and kind of questioning China's present and thereby the future, because the Yellow River is very emblematic of Chinese culture as a whole. So it just started with those questions, but then sometime in the 1980s, they added the second stanza. And then that becomes this kind of affirmative answer. There are infinite number of bends in the Yellow River. It's kind of, and the way that he sings it adds to these narratives. So he will walk out onto the stage at the beginning of the song, and there's a kind of instrumental, it's pre-recorded, and there's this instrumental interlude at the beginning. And he walks out to the center of the stage and he looks back at whatever the backdrop is. And he performs this at a variety of events. So there will be business openings, there will be weddings, there will be Chinese New Year performances, but there's always some kind of backdrop. So it might say like the wedding or the name of the business or whatever. And he's looking back at it. And then as he starts singing, "Do you know how many bends there are?" he turns around and faces the audience. And when he does that, you know, at the beginning, you only see the back of his head. So there's this kind of anonymity and invisibility to it. And then he turns and you're like, oh, it's the Folktown King of Western China. There's that kind of hyper visibility, just like you see in the region and in China. And then as he's singing the song, when he gets to the second verse, he starts like raising his head. Sometimes there will be like a walkway that goes into the center of the audience, and he starts walking forward into the audience. So he's bringing this kind of sense of, he's going from this kind of connection to the past and bringing it into the center of the audience and sort of projecting it towards this future as he's singing about the kind of success, which is the 99 bends of the Yellow River. And that narrative of sort of fusing together the past, present, and future really ties into these kind of transformative events. So if it's a New Year's performance, you know, it's like saying goodbye to the old year and hello to the new year. If it's a wedding, it's joining together these two people into a new kind of social unit. If it's a business opening, it's giving birth to this new business. That kind of narrative of where have we come from and where are we going seems to prove really useful in that kind of event. And at the same time, his performance of it, because that song has been performed so many times over the years by him and by other singers as well, it really connects these kind of events to this larger stream of history. And I think it helps people in the audience to kind of connect that sense to this larger stream as well. And what's interesting is when he's singing the second part, he says, you know, the first part is, "Do you know how many bends?" And the second part is, "I know." But when he's singing the "I know," the audience is like singing along with him. So they're singing "I," and there's this kind of collective "we" happening. So there's this sort of juxtaposition of the individual and the collective. You know, he's this individual singer, but he's representing this larger group. And then I think that's kind of modeling how one might sort of socialize personal experience. So when the audience is singing along and singing I know, they're also kind of joining their narratives into these other narratives, or at least seeing how that would be. I think that song allows us to experience things in an as if kind of manner.
Really fascinating, and what an amazing way to sort of end up the body of the book. Following this, you have this sort of conclusionary section or this epilogue where you talk about the concept of song kings and queens that you'd advanced at the beginning. Particularly in the perspective of world music, how do you envision the place of song king and queen and this concept in world music?
So What I try to argue in the epilogue is that even though the terms Song King and Song Queen are Chinese, I think that although in Chinese they are often applied to singers from other genres, I think that if we take that idea of Song King and Song Queen as a singer who's representative of larger groups, and we take a more kind of global view of these terms, it really highlights what's happening with singers around the world who move from rural to urban landscapes, transforming themselves and the local traditions they carry with them into symbols of larger regions, of nations, of peoples, of epochs. And in the process of that transition, the singers are physically embodying mediation between groups through their travels, through their lives, through their performances and the songs they sing. And at the same time, as that's happening, the events from their life stories spark public interest, and they become discursive sites for social tensions as people strive to redefine themselves amidst a constantly changing world. Tying into what I talked about, the rags to riches stories and the sort of romance stories. And more globally, many of these singers live during transitional times. Their lives coincide with the rise of new nations and historical periods. For example, there was a singer known as the Voice of Egypt, Umm Kulthum, who brought a rural art form to urban Cairo and then connected a national Egyptian identity to the surrounding Arab world through her performances. In Japan, you have the Queen of Enka, Misora Hibari, who became a national icon in the years of post-war Japan. And then the list goes on and on. There's a Scottish folk singer, Jeannie Robertson, who represented Scottish traveler culture to large audiences. In America, we might think of people like Bob Dylan, Leadbelly, Pete Seeger, and more. Each of these singers' careers involved a movement in time and space between the context in which the performer first encountered their songs and the places and people to whom he or she later performed them. And through those performances, the singers were able to mediate between ethnic groups, socioeconomic classes, localities, regions, nations, and eras. And so I think that Wang's example gives a really good insight into part of this process that I think we can think about in the context of other cases where, as singers speak to larger and larger and more diverse social spheres, they learn to pivot their presentation of self, gloss over the heterogeneity of different peoples and places in favor of a kind of symbolic unity. And all of that, preferably, of course, with the singer, him or herself at the center.
Amazing. And that seems really relevant, given our current moment feels like there's a lot of transition going on. Well, unfortunately, I think that's just about all the time we have, or at least that we've taken up all of the time that I feel comfortable taking up of yours. Before we let you go, though, I was wondering if you could tell us what you're working on now. What's up next?
Sure, thanks. So I'm working on two projects right now. One is an edited volume about the cultural politics of singers and songs around the world, sort of expanding on some of the ideas from the book's epilogue. So I want to kind of have this edited volume with different scholars explore ways in which singers and songs of different genres have come to represent regions, nations, and historical moments, while simultaneously becoming sites of public interest through which to consider questions of individual and collective identities. So that's one project. And the other one is my second book monograph, which is on regional stories as ethical conversations. At the moment, I'm calling it A Region of Rebels, Visions of the Yellow Earth in the Chinese Moral Landscape. And I'm looking at novels, TV dramas, musicals, and films set again in this region, spanning from its ancient past to the revolutionary period in the 1930s and 40s, and up to recent novels about the rise of regional coal bosses whose overnight wealth and power puts mainstream narratives of economic development in tension with concerns about political corruption and environmental degradation. And what's kind of interesting to me in that project is how regional characters have this kind of hybrid nature. They belong to other parts of one's own national community. And so when they attempt to resolve social problems that are shared by national audiences, their actions often appear kind of ethically ambiguous because they're caught between overlapping moral orders of regions and the nation. So I'm hoping to focus on how regional stories juxtapose these different scales of ethical judgment, and in doing so, force audiences to compare contrasting perspectives and thereby strengthen their own moral imagination.
Sounds really amazing. Can't wait to see them coming out. Thanks very much, Levy, for your time today and for telling us about this new book of yours.
Thanks a lot for having me, Tim. I appreciate it.